Last week was finals week here at Wyoming Catholic College, as students report back to their professors on what they learned through the spring semester. More important than that, however, is that the week ended with commencement and with bidding farewell to our seniors. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. The last author our seniors concentrate on in their humanities track is poet T.S. Eliot. While Geoffrey Chaucer in the Canterbury Tales extolled the loveliness of April when spring fills the earth with beauty and with great joy people long to go on pilgrimages, T.S. Eliot, with as much Christian conviction as Chaucer, called April in our modern secular age the cruelest month, and describes the crowds with their backs turned to the pilgrim road to Canterbury as they slog into London for another workday. Dr. Glenn Arbery, in addition to being our college president, has been teaching senior humanities, and I asked him why our seniors end their years at Wyoming Catholic College with T.S. Eliot.
Eliot's really the great poet of the 20th century, especially for those in our tradition. He's very famous for his 1927 proclamation that he was a royalist in politics, a classicist in literature, and an Anglo-Catholic in religion. It was a startling kind of admission for anybody to make, especially someone who had been at the forefront of the modernist movement in poetry. And Eliot went on to become one of the great conservative Christian voices of our age. And there's hardly anybody who could qualify as a better ending to the whole sweep of our curriculum than T.S. Eliot, who certainly had that whole sweep of it in his own imagination.
Now, what specifically do our students read?
They read The Wasteland and The Four Quartets. This year, by a kind of serendipity, they were also engaged in acting in Murder in the Cathedral, which is the first play that Eliot wrote about St. Thomas Becket. I think about a third of the class ended up performing in that play, which was directed by Mrs. Denise Trawl and her son Thomas. And when we got into the discussions of Eliot in class, they were seeing all kinds of connections back and forth between the text of the play and the text of the poems that we did. So that was very very good coincidence, I would say.
Why those choices? Why The Four Quartets and The Wasteland?
The Wasteland is probably the pivotal poem of the 20th century in English. It was a kind of watershed. It was extremely difficult to understand, but obviously important from the first time that people read it. So coming to terms with the fragmentary nature of the writing, all the allusions to other works, the switches between languages and voices seemed so important in getting at the particular character of what had happened to Western civilization by the early 20th century. It itself was in fragments, and Eliot picked up the tone of it, the despairing outlook on things that tended to pervade most of the society that he saw. And it was one of those poems that everyone read and that everyone came to terms with. And so The Wasteland, you know, is sort of the classic of the early 20th century, as Paradise Lost might be for the second half of the 17th century. The Four Quartets are Eliot's great testament to his Christianity. I mean, I think that's one way to put it. They're abstract, they're difficult like his other poems, but there are lines in them that you find yourself coming back to over and over and that deepen the older you get, I find. You know, it's interesting how Eliot continues to grow on you the more you read him.
Mm-hmm. Now, in an open letter you wrote to our seniors, you quoted the line from Eliot, "The only wisdom we can hope to acquire is the wisdom of humility. Humility is endless." Tell us about that and how it reflects your hope for our seniors.
Interesting question. What Eliot is getting at, of course, is his own humility, I think, before the whole tradition. He, early on in his career, wrote an essay called Tradition and the Individual Talent, in which he said that it wasn't the personality of the writer that should be expressed, but in fact, the writer should seek a kind of impersonality the more he took on the character of his own age with respect to all the great works of the past. I think when Eliot looked at his own writing and he was looking back at Shakespeare and Dante and Virgil and Ovid and Homer, he realized that his work didn't have the same quality or character as theirs, but he was trying. You know, he was doing the best that he could in his own age to live up to the kind of poetry that he saw them achieving. So when he talks about humility being endless, I think he's aware of how much there is that is greater than he is. Certainly it's a humility before God, but also before the whole tradition. That's the hope I have for our seniors, frankly, that if this education has given them something strong, it's not arrogance. It's not the sense that, you know, we go out of here knowing things that other people don't know, but a kind of humility before the whole of what there is to know, and the sense that they're just beginning to get a feel for the whole richness of what's there. And I think Eliot is a wonderful guide into that kind of humility.
Now, on the opposite side of things, the lines from Eliot that have always haunted me are from Chorus from the Rock. And the wind will say, here were a decent, godless people. Their only monument, the asphalt road, and 1,000 lost golf balls. Well, I'm rather fond of roads, and I have personally lost thousands of golf balls. But I fear for myself, and I fear that we're releasing our students into the kind of world where being decent, godless people is the expectation and the path of least resistance.
Well, I think that's certainly true. Eliot was very aware of the modern world, you know, the modern project of improvement in terms of technological progress and so on. A decent, godless people, they're sort of like Nietzsche's last men. They seek out their comforts and they don't really aspire to anything more than what the, you know, your good coffee in the morning and your nice meal at night and your 8 hours of sleep and good traffic patterns and entertainments. That's the whole of the perspective on life. Eliot certainly sees past that. There are wonderful passages in Four Quartets when he sort of evokes a via negativa, you know, this path of ascesis, of giving things up that he finds in John of the Cross and others. So that instead of being satisfied with the minor pleasures of the modern world, you go deeper, you wait, you hope that God will show you something that is beyond what the contemporary world has to offer and its kind of glibness. And I think that's what's so profound about Eliot. He's one of the only real poets in the 20th century who keeps pointing in that spiritual direction, despite the, you know, having kind of daily life solved, as you know, as the people with the asphalt roads and all those golf balls to lose. I never had that many golf balls. So, yeah.
Now, of course, Eliot was a poet, and in his essay, The Social Function of Poetry, he wrote, "What I am apprehensive of is death, that the feeling for poetry, that the feelings which are the material of poetry may disappear everywhere." Could you make a comment about poetry in our age? And in light of that, how do our students respond to Eliot?
Well, first of all, poetry in our age. I read a statistic the other day that was startling to me, which is that people have started to read poetry at a greater clip than they have in decades. I don't know what that means. I don't know what they're reading either. I don't know what kind of poetry it is. It's interesting, too, that Eliot always emphasizes feeling in poetry. You would think that a poet as difficult as he is would emphasize some kind of intellectual act that is necessary for you truly to understand poetry. But rather than that, he's always talking about how poetry can work on feeling before you even understand it, more or less as music can. So when he's talking about the feeling that might be lost, I suspect it's another version of what he means by the asphalt roads and the golf balls. That is, everything gets standardized. There's certain kinds of acceptable pleasures and acceptable thoughts. And the way that poetry reaches into the soul and evokes certain almost unnameable, unsayable feelings is rather, you know, in hard times when you have the world as we now have it, with the media as we now have it, and so on. Those moments of quiet with a book of poetry are not common anymore. Even reading novels as people used to read them is not as common. So I think Eliot is probably foreseeing that as he makes that comment. I hope that our students, in the course of their 4 years here and all the poems they memorize, begin to have that kind of appreciation for the feeling. You know, I had an essay in my book several years back, and the chapter title was The Intelligence of Feeling. And it's about how much goes into a feeling. You know, how many complicated ideas and experiences go into a simple feeling. So when you meet somebody and you have a feeling about them, there's a whole history of experience that lies behind that. Similarly, I think with poetry, and poetry can educate feeling as well as evoke it. And I think that's what we hope will happen here with the poetic education that we give our students.
For our listeners, can they jump right into Eliot? And if so, where?
Well, you can jump in. You know, reading The Wasteland, it got some interesting reactions from our students. They thought it was incomprehensible. The more they talked about it, the more they realized it was comprehensible. It's just difficult. But, you know, I would say some of Eliot's early poems would be a good start. The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock is, you know, about a man trying to make a proposal to a woman and talking himself out of it, but it's not that difficult. And also, I would suggest certain books if you're really interested in Eliot. Russell Kirk has a wonderful book called Eliot and His Age, which I think is the perfect introduction to him. And a friend of mine, Ben Lockard, who has spoken on these podcasts, has a book called Ethereal Rumors, which is about Eliot and physics, which is, you know, sounds arcane, but really gets at the heart of much of what Eliot's doing. One of my old teachers, Marion Montgomery, has a book called The Reflective Journey Toward Order, which is about Eliot. So all of those are good ways in, I think. But best thing is just to jump in, start reading, see where you get.
We become mechanized in mind, wrote T.S. Eliot in his essay, The Man of Letters and the Future of Europe, and consequently attempt to provide solutions in terms of engineering for problems, which are essentially problems of life. Close quote. As the old saying goes, to the man who only owns a hammer, every problem is a nail. And much of our current education provides graduates with one or possibly two tools. Liberal education provides an entire garage full of tools with which to analyze actual engineering problems, and more important, to analyze the problems of life, our individual lives, our lives in community, local, national, and global. As we end another successful academic year here at Wyoming Catholic College, will you consider a gift to the college to support our undergraduate liberal arts program and our adult distance learning programs, which include this podcast? Thank you in advance. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.